Well, thank you, Brother Conley. It's a good song. We won't sing that one as often, but it's especially that second verse talking about how we look around and the world doesn't know the kind of life that the Christian can live if he's enjoying Christ the way that he's supposed to. And we're going to see about that a little bit this morning in Jeremiah. We're going to be in chapter 46, Jeremiah chapter 46. If you didn't get a handout, raise your hand. I want to make sure everybody got one on the way in. I think we did pretty good. Everybody has one on the when they got in? Good, good. Thank you, Brother Paul. I appreciate that. Over here, do we need a couple? Brother Paul, right down here in the middle section, these two ladies. Thank you very much. Appreciate you grabbing everybody on the way in. We're going to be in chapter 46. So you may recall, you might not, but a long time ago when we started the book of Jeremiah, and I gave you the super broad outline of the book, what he covers where, you might remember that most of the book is about Jeremiah's message to Judah and all of the varying facets of that, and to the different people and to different circumstances and to the different kings. But the very last section of the book is not a message to Judah, but it's a message to the other nations. So look at verse number 1 of Jeremiah chapter 46. The word of the Lord which came to Jeremiah the prophet against the Gentiles. And so from chapter 46 all the way to chapter 51, he's not preaching to Israel. He's not preaching to Judah. He's not preaching to their kings. He's preaching to everyone else. And so I gave you a brief list of where we're going to be going. Super easy to tell you where we're going to go because he's got a different message to different people, to different groups, to different nations. We've just been talking about Egypt recently. Israel has decided that the safest place in the world to be is not at home, and it's not in God's will, it's in Egypt. And so it's appropriate that he begins this section with a message to them. It's also appropriate to who he ends the section with, because he finishes this whole section, chapter 50 and 51, both of them extremely long chapters, with a message to Babylon. And so we're going to look at each of these as we go through these next few weeks, which takes us basically to the end of the book. But it's very appropriate that it's beginning with Egypt. Egypt was where Israel just fled in the last few chapters. That's where they were at when they were when Babylon took them over and they left. God told them to stay, but they all chose to pack up and move to Babylon because they thought that was the safest place it was going to be. But the story of Egypt, though, is ages old. It also goes back to the beginning. The story of Egypt goes back to the beginning of Jeremiah's ministry. We might assume that because we've just been talking about Egypt, that the setting of the chapter is going to be more recent. It's going to be set at the moment that Babylon took Judah over and that Israel's living in Judah. That's going to happen later. But this is a different section of the book. Remember, Jeremiah doesn't write in chronological order. The book is set in order of topic. And the topic of the back half of this book is messages to other people. So the first half of chapter 46 is not taking place in the very next moment after chapter 44 and 45 closed. It actually takes place a long time before. But these messages shine a couple different truths out to us. One of them is that just because God is judging his own people, Judah and Israel, does not mean that he overlooks the wickedness of the other nations around them. Because in all these chapters, what we're going to see is that God notices the evil of Egypt. He sees the evil of Moab. He understands what's going on in Edom and Damascus and Tyre. And he's not going to overlook the evil of Babylon either. Just because he's using these wicked nations in his plan in this world does not mean that evil will go unpunished or that things will go without being made right. And so these passages teach us this as well. But it also helps us to look into the lives of these nations and helps us to see them as the vulnerable people they are. Because as we've been paying attention to Israel, as we've been paying attention to Judah, and we see all these nations rising and falling, it can almost appear that Israel's vulnerable and the rest of the world was not. They're the ones with the strength. They're the ones with the power. They're the ones with the stability. And as we read these chapters, we quickly recognize that they don't have the stability that they claim to have or that we think that they have. And so we're going to look at some of these, and today we're going to look at just Egypt, chapter 46. We're going to do the whole message to Egypt, but we're just going to talk about them. And what I see in Egypt is he gives a couple different messages to them, and we see Egypt starting out well, or I say well, we see them starting out confidently, but end up doing very poorly at the end. The confidence of this world in their own ability to take care of themselves fails them. And so very quickly, as we look at the message to Egypt, I want us to see the world stages of confronting challenges. So that's your first point, number one, the world stages of confronting challenges. So we're going to read the passage. Stage number one of how the world confronts challenges around them is, letter A, confidence. Confidence. They start confidently. Why? Because they're told to be confident, by the way, first of all. Kids, today, the world is your oyster. You can do anything you want to do. You can be anything you want to be. Take the world by storm. Go out and try your hardest, and no matter everything that you want will just lay out in front of you if you do it well enough or hard enough or long enough. And there's a certain extent where that's true, where it's good to try your best. It's good to do the best that you can do. It's not good to sit back and just let things be as they are. However, you can only trust your ability to make the world how you want it to be to so much extent. And so I want us to look at where this starts. So look at verse number 2, and we have to introduce the setting before we get into the message. Verse number 2 of chapter 46. So he says that the message is to the Gentiles, but now he says it's against Egypt, specifically this one. Against the army of Pharaoh Necho, king of Egypt, which was by the river Euphrates in Carchemish, which Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, smote in the fourth year of Jehoiakim, the son of Josiah, king of Judah. Now pause. We now have a timestamp on when this first part of the message actually is given. And it's not recent. It's not at the very end of Israel's fall. It's actually at the very beginning of the stories of this book. When Jeremiah's ministry was beginning, the king was not Jehoiakim or Zedekiah. I think you still have your timeline in your handout. The king was Josiah. And some big world events are happening right now. Assyria, the major world power at that time, which had been the thorn in Israel's side for generations now, is starting to lose some power. They're starting to lose some influence. At this point in time in their history, they began to pay attention less to their military borders and their fortresses, and historically, they started to pay attention more to art and literature and culture, which is fine. It just meant they weren't, like, keeping their borders as safe because their attention was somewhere else. And they didn't realize that at that same time, a man named Nabopolassar, all the way down in Babylon, was starting to rise to power. Him and his son, Nebuchadnezzar, decided they want to restore the old Babylonian Empire. And so they marched up north all the way in the east along the Euphrates River, and they started to take strongholds of Assyria until they got to Nineveh, which was Assyria's big fortress, their capital city. And they couldn't take it, but Babylon made an alliance with the Median Empire, which is what the Medes and the Persians, that they were later friends. And they took Nineveh. And so now Assyria is retreating, and Assyria is coming backwards, and Assyria finds its way all the way to the last stronghold of their empire, which is Carchemish, which is actually the city that was mentioned here. And Babylon is beating them back. Well, Assyria was friends with Egypt, and Pharaoh Necho was the pharaoh at that time. So Pharaoh Necho chooses to go up north to help Assyria at the last battle of Carchemish. And we know this story because this is the story where Josiah dies. Josiah does not want Pharaoh to help Assyria because he wants Babylon to win. Because Assyria is their enemy at this time. And Babylon, who knows who they are, but if they get rid of Assyria, then we're all for that. So he doesn't want Pharaoh to help Assyria because he doesn't want Assyria to win because he wants them to fall. And Josiah ends up fighting against Pharaoh, and he ends up dying in that battle. But we're not talking about Josiah right now. We're talking about Pharaoh. Pharaoh, he says, has marched up to Carchemish with this big vision in mind. He's going to help Assyria. They're going to win. They're going to take their army, all their soldiers, all their horses, all their chariots. They're going to beat down the Babylonian Empire. They're going to make a name for themselves. They're going to rise to power. And this is how he paints them. He says, so I'm going to talk to you, Pharaoh, who has gone all the way up with all these big hopes in mind. Look at verse number 3. Almost facetiously, he says this. Order ye the buckler and shield. Draw near to battle. Harness the horses. And get up, ye horsemen. Stand forth with your helmets. Furbish the spears. Put on the brigandines, which is your armor. Wherefore have I seen them dismayed and turned back? Their mighty ones are beaten down and are fled apace. And look not back, for fear was round about, saith the Lord. Let not the swift flee away, or the mighty man escape. They shall stumble and fall toward the north by the river Euphrates. But he goes back to their confidence. Who is this that cometh up as a flood, whose waters are moved as the rivers? Egypt riseth up like a flood, and his waters are moved like the rivers. And he saith, I will go up, I will cover the earth, I will destroy the city and the inhabitants thereof. Come up, ye horses, and rage, ye chariots, and let the mighty men come forth. The Ethiopians, the Libyans that handle the shield, the Lydians that handle and bend the bow. So he says to the Egyptians, go ahead, brandish your weapons, harness your horses, put on your armor. They said they would sweep everyone away like the Nile does. They had friends in high places and influential countries. They had skills. They were confident. But the passage reminds us of how their confidence went, because we know the story. They did not win that battle. Babylon defeated the Assyrians and the Egyptians at Carchemish and solidified their control over the world. The Egyptians were not successful, regardless of how confident they had been in themselves. The world tells us that we should be very confident. Everything's going to go well. The young people go out and everything's going to go easy for them. But that doesn't mean they actually know what they're doing. Nor does it mean that they have the skills to take care of themselves. So every kid that I've met has a different personality, and that manifests itself also with how they interact with their world, like babies and toddlers. It's interesting to see how different they really are. Some kids, you see, they're very timid. They're afraid of new things. They're afraid of what they haven't done before if they're not familiar with it. Not my kid. Levi is confident to a fault. He knows not to walk down the steps because mommy and daddy told him not to. But the reason we told him not to is because he didn't know how to walk down steps. But he'll try whether he knows how to or not. If we let him, he'll walk off the edge of the steps, and he doesn't know how to go down. But he'll figure it out as he tumbles. And so we tell him, no, we close the gate when daddy comes up the steps. We're trying to teach him. And the reason we're trying very carefully to teach him is because if we give him a little too much leash, he'll take it and he will fly somewhere. We put him down somewhere, strange place. We put him down, he takes off. We have to run after him. We went to Sam's church out in California there on Wednesday, and we wanted him to meet a couple people. And he was fine. He was in a good mood. We put him down, and instead of meeting the people right in front of us, he went down the aisle and turned a corner and was off somewhere else. He'd never been in this room before, but he was going to explore the whole thing before we were done. He has got a confidence, but he doesn't know what he's doing. And that's why we're scared to death to let him just go off and figure it out. But it's okay. That's not a bad thing, because we're just trying to teach him that in spite of the amount of confidence that you have to also learn to trust us, that we know what's going on. And that's the thing. God looks down at us like we do on babies like that. We think we have it all under control. We think we're going to be fine. And we don't know what we're doing. And God says, listen, you got to have to trust me before you trust yourself, because I know you think you have everything under control, but you don't. And so if you just learn to obey, we'll be fine. But if you start to trust you, you're not going to be fine. Sometimes we just try to convince ourselves, everything's going to be fine. I'm actually known for that. I found that out the last few months, that one of the things I'm known for saying around the church office is, it'll be fine. Apparently the Hewitts say it at home, to almost kind of jokingly about me, it'll be fine, it'll be fine. Because I say it all the time, because when I feel like things are out of control, I don't have a handle on things, it makes me feel better if I just say, it'll be fine. But that doesn't mean that it is fine. And that's how people deal with life. We're going to get to that in just a second. But the Bible says this about our wisdom. 1 Corinthians 3, the wisdom of this world is foolishness with God. It is written, he taketh the wise in their own craftiness. Again, the Lord knoweth the thoughts of the wise, that they are vain. The people of the world try to take the world by the horns, but it doesn't turn out well for them. And so that takes us to letter B. They start with confidence, and that turns into retreat. Retreat. So we saw in the midst of his explanation, take your swords, take your horses, take your chariots, try to take the world by storm. But we find out how it happened. Verse number 5, wherefore have I seen them dismayed and turned away back? Their mighty ones are beaten down and are fled apace and look not back, for fear was round about them. They ran and they didn't look behind them. He says in verse 6, let not the swift flee away or the mighty man escape. They stumble and fall toward the north by the river Euphrates. Look down at verse number 10. The Bible says why they lost, because God wasn't with them. This is the day of the Lord God of hosts, a day of vengeance, that he may avenge him of his adversaries. The sword shall devour, and it shall be and it shall be satiate and made drunk with their blood. For the Lord God of hosts hath a sacrifice in the north country by the river Euphrates. And he tells them, you're not going to find help anywhere else. Go up to Gilead and take balm, O virgin, the daughter of Egypt. In vain shalt thou use many medicines, for thou shalt not be cured. Gilead, we talked about this earlier in Jeremiah. They were known to have a balm, to have certain medicines that they would use to help cure wounds. And Jeremiah would say, don't we have a balm in Gilead to cure our own wounds? And God says, no, you can't cure yourself. He says the same thing to Egypt. Look at verse 12. The nations have heard of thy shame, and thy cry hath filled the land. For the mighty man hath stumbled against the mighty, and they are fallen both together. So you have one moment where he's jokingly telling them, or facetiously telling them, that they should go up and take their weapons, take their spears, take their horses, take their chariots, and fight this battle because you're going to sweep all your enemies away like a flood, aren't you? And yet they ran back and did not look behind them because they had been cursed. They had lost because they were not blessed by God. Now, that was that battle. This is a message to Egypt. Jeremiah puts his messages together by topic and not by order. We have one more message in this chapter, which is not written at the very beginning of the book of Jeremiah, when Pharaoh first fought with Assyria, when Babylon was first rising to power, when Josiah was still alive. The second half takes place most likely all the way at the end, right after Israel's living in Egypt, after they ran down to Egypt for help, after Babylon had risen to power and taken their deportations of people several times. And he writes to them here, but they're in a completely different situation now. So I want you to look at it. Look at the next verse. Verse number 13. The word that the Lord spake to Jeremiah the prophet, how Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, should come and smite the land of Egypt. He made many to fall. Yea, one fell upon another, and they said, arise, let us go again to our own people, to the land of our nativity, from the oppressing sword. So we're going to continue on this section, but what I want you to see is the difference between these two settings. In the first story, Egypt has its weapons and its horses and its chariots, and they are marching away in order to fight a battle somewhere else, in order to gain power out in the world. And in the second story, you have Egypt holed up at home. They have retreated back home. They've gone to their own people, to their own land, to the land of their nativity, it says. This is where we're from, and we're just going to hole up here. Completely different situation, isn't it? You have them going forth in confidence, and now you have them retreating backwards in defeat and in fear. We've met those people, haven't we? They tried big success. They wanted the world as their oyster, but it was hard. So they retreated and holed in on themselves and found what was most comfortable, what was the easiest thing. They find the easiest job and the easiest pastimes and engage in only the easiest commitments and have only the easiest conversations because they realize that all the confidence they placed in themselves was misplaced. And all the things they thought they were going to do was really hard, and they couldn't in their own power. And so now they're just going to, letter C, survive. We go from conquer to retreat to survival mode. Now I just have to get through without falling apart. When we place confidence in us and we're gonna figure it all out ourselves, we end up going very quickly from confidence to survival. We all met those people too, but let's go to see what they're saying. Verse 14. It says, declare ye in Egypt and publish in Migdal and publish in Noph and Tapanes, all these major cities up the Nile River. Say ye, stand fast and prepare thee, for the sword shall devour round about thee. Why are thy valiant men swept away? They stood not, because the Lord did drive them. Here they are in Egypt. They might have had their mighty men defending their gates of their city, but they're not out conquering. They're at home, trying to survive, trying not to lose the country. Many people find themselves in this spot very quickly. Countless people I have met out on the streets or neighbors or out door knocking are in this spot. You meet the young person who has dreams and goals. They think that they have the talent and the capability to take the world by storm. And then you find the middle-aged person who's living in their house with their kids, with their jobs. Their hopes and dreams is that they can pay their bills and not get evicted. They aren't worrying about college acceptance letters. They're worrying about having money for Cheerios. That's the state that they're at. Confidence, retreat, survival. And so what do when they don't know how to handle the world's problems? Because at this point, they would do what they should do if they knew what to do, but they don't. So letter D, they end up ignoring and procrastinating. Ignoring and procrastinating. By the way, our fellows are going to come by in a second. You could just take your attendance slip and drop it in. We'd appreciate that so we know who's here in Sunday school. Ignoring and procrastinating. Look at this brief statement that they make about their Pharaoh. You know, their Pharaoh, the one who took them to battle earlier, is probably not the same one anymore, but their leader, they're looking to him for help. Rumors are stirring, messages are being brought. Egypt or Babylon is coming. No one has withstood them before. The odds of us defeating Babylon are very little. We lost against them last time when we were allied with Assyria when it still had power. Babylon has only gotten stronger. We have only gotten weaker, and they are coming. Pharaoh, what do we do? I don't know. Look at verse number 17. They did cry there, Pharaoh, king of Egypt, is but a noise, and he hath passed the time appointed. People are trying to hold up, and they're trying to hold out. They look at their leader, who is making a sound like everything is okay, but what he is saying to them is but noise compared to the situation that they have. He has passed the time appointed. The time that has come for him to react has come and it is gone. But what is Pharaoh supposed to do? He doesn't know. So he waits and he procrastinates and does nothing. I'm a procrastinator by nature. Not by nature, probably by spirit because I'm a sinful person. But I'm a procrastinator and I shouldn't be. And there's a lot of psychological reasons why we might procrastinate. There was a TED Talk given when somebody said that the reason why is the moment you try to do something, there is an instant gratification monkey that appears in our brain, and we get distracted by it. I don't know how scientific that is, but regardless, the reason why you procrastinate is not usually because you want to do something and then you just choose not to. It's because you usually don't know what to do or where to begin. That's usually when you procrastinate. I don't know if you're like me, but when I look at a project and I don't know where to start or I don't know how to continue, that's when I end up getting distracted by the instant gratification monkey in my brain because I can't focus in on it if I don't know how to handle it. And that's when we procrastinate and push it off. See, the moment where you're in the middle of doing a project and you're on a roll, you can't stop because it's like, it's just going. The moment I'm writing a sermon and it's like I can't type as fast as my brain is going, I don't stop in the middle and go have a conversation with somebody because I know where I'm going with it. I know what I'm doing. I know what I'm writing. So why do we procrastinate when we don't? It's because we don't know what to do. And what I've noticed too is I try to curb my procrastination in my life by making my life more structured. So I have a lot of Apple products, and so they all interact with each other. And so if I tell Siri to remind me to do something, she will. But I've found that reminders are not nearly as helpful as I want them to be. Because when my phone or my computer dings me and says, hey, you need to do this, it doesn't tell me what to do or where to begin. And it doesn't make it less hard. And so it's really easy to just click the down arrow and say, remind me tomorrow. And then it'll ding me tomorrow morning. And then I go, oh yeah, I gotta do that. Just because I had a reminder to do it doesn't mean I actually know what to do. This world is filled with people who are procrastinating and ignoring the problems in their life, not because they're technically particularly irresponsible people, but because they don't even know where to begin. The person who goes from, I'm going to take the world by storm, to, I can't do that, so I just need to survive when the bill comes in the mail that they don't know how to pay, what do? They put it in the drawer because it's a lot nicer not to see it if I don't know how to pay it. When the problem comes, the difficult conversation opportunity arises, we don't have that conversation because we don't even know how to have the conversation, so we never do. And so we ignore and procrastinate with life's problems because we recognize we can't handle it and we wouldn't even know where to begin. That's what Pharaoh did. What else was he supposed to do? I don't know how to defend Egypt from Babylon. He didn't either. Letter E. So where do we come to when we realize we can't handle it on our own? We trust others to save us. We trust others to save us. So he's talking to Egypt. And he says, no, Babylon's going to come. Look at verse 18. As I live, saith the king, whose name is the Lord of hosts. By the way, I like that. He says to the king that the real king is the Lord and not you. The king who is the Lord. Surely as Tabor is among the mountains and as Carmel by the sea, so shall he come. What is he saying there? Tabor is a mountain and it's among the mountains. That's what it is. That's just the truth. Carmel is a mountain and it's by the sea. That's what it is. It just is that way. And just as Tabor is a mountain and Carmel is by the sea, so Babylon will come. It just is what it is. It's gonna be. So he goes on, verse 19. O thou daughter dwelling in Egypt, furnish thyself to go into captivity. For Noph shall be waste and desolate without an inhabitant. Egypt is like a very fair heifer, but destruction cometh. It cometh out of the north. A heifer like a bull. The Egyptians worshipped the god Apis, which was a bull god. The idea of destruction cometh is almost like a word picture. Like they trust in their bull god, Babylon will come like a goad against them or like a fly on their back. They think they're fine, but they're going to have destruction coming their way. Look at verse 21. Also, and this is what I wanted to point out, talking to Egypt, her hired men are in the midst of her like fatted bullocks, for they also are turned back and are fled away together. They did not stand because the day of their calamity was come upon them and the time of their visitation. This is what I wanted to focus on. So Egypt, how we started this chapter, with their mighty men and their spears and their swords and their chariots and their horses left to go to battle against Babylon, we find them in the next one at home. Pharaoh is wasting his time. He doesn't know what to do. And he reminds them that Egypt's hired men have abandoned them. So Egypt, which had their own army, which was going to conquer Babylon, is now at home and has to hire other people to keep them safe. You see the progression here? They went from, we're going to take somebody else's land, to we can't even keep our own land without somebody else's help. And this is where we get to next, isn't it? Now, it's not bad to ask people for help, especially with things you don't know what you're doing. Like, I don't know what I'm doing with computers, for example. So a few months ago, we were talking about Sam has a lot of photography business that she ends up doing, and so she was having a lot of jobs editing, and her computer was having trouble catching up. And so I asked my brother, Sterl, who actually knows what he's talking about, to help us with a Christmas gift. I wanted to buy Sam a new computer, and so Thurl built her a new PC, and so he did it for us for Christmas, and I paid for it for Christmas, because I have no idea what I'm doing. And so in the initial setup, a lot of really simple questions came up that I didn't know the answer to. So what did I do? Thurl, it's doing a thing, and I don't know what it is. And he tells me, and that's okay. When we don't know what we're doing, we go to somebody else for help. But what happens is when the world doesn't know how to handle their life, they end up feeling like everybody else has to pick up the pieces for them. This is how they normally handle everyday things. Let me illustrate. But Psalm 118 says this: it's better to trust in the Lord than to put confidence in man. It's better to trust in the Lord than put confidence in princes. So are we watching the spiral downward here? Now the person is lost in the hole of just getting by to such an extent that they need others to make sure that they can get through their days. They now need the government to give them money to survive. They now need their family, extended family, to take care of their family for them. They now need their sibling to come and clean up their house. They now need others to do it for them because they cannot do it on their own. Now, I'm not saying that we should be more self-sufficient. Like, I should be able to do it on my own, because that's where Egypt was. They started with, I can do it on my own. No, I can't. Somebody else has to do it for me. Our problem is when we live in this horizontal realm, we just find ourselves flailing for help. At first, we trust us and we fail, and then we trust others. And then what happens when we trust other people is they're not always there for us. When he brings up all these hired men, he's bringing them up to remind them they all went home too. And so what do? We get angry at everyone else because they're not picking up the pieces right. There's a lot of people I've met that they expect everyone around them to get them through life. And when everyone else doesn't take care of themselves and them, they're bad people. But you know why? Because they don't know what else to do. It's just this last couple weeks. Years ago, before we were married, the year between college and when we were married, she worked at a children's home. And so it was an interesting setup. It was a children's home slash school. So there were some people that came to the school that didn't live in the children's home. But by and large, everybody that was there was from a broken family, or they were an orphan, or they were from kids, their families where the parents did drugs, or they just didn't want their kids. So they sent them to this home. So the kids basically grew up there. And based on varying circumstances, sometimes the difficult home life that they had before, and sometimes their ability to help with little babies while they were there, because there was all these different ages there. Several of these girls that Sam had taught as in high school, she notices on Facebook that after they would get out of high school or not get out of high school, they wanted to start a family immediately, whether they were married or not. And so several of the people that she had taught had actually, for a brief amount of time, they had gotten pregnant out of wedlock. And then, of course, the guy is gone, and they're proud to have this baby that they really wanted. But then eventually it circles back around, and they're messaging all of their Facebook friends because they now need help with the problems that they have in their life, which are inevitably a result of the decisions that they made. Now, I'm not a very merciful person by nature, and sometimes it shows up with the fact that I struggle helping people with the issues that they have put into their life for a couple reasons. One is because the moment you help them once, you're going to help them again, because until they make different decisions, their problems aren't going to go away. And the other is some of the problems might be the Lord doing it in their life because he needs to get their attention, and I don't want to come in and swoop and save the day. I'm not a super stingy person. When we have somebody in town, like a missionary or something, we'll give them a huge gift because we know it will be used well. But this is what happens. So she messages all their people. And this happened several times. And then later on, you see them post on Facebook, all of my friends are fake. No one will help me. I'm deleting all my friends. And so now it's everyone else's fault, right? We've all had that. Every one of us probably in here has been in that spot. We don't know what to do anymore. And so then we say, well, somebody else has to pick up the pieces. And then they abandon us. And now we more don't know what to do. And so what do we do next? Letter F, we trust religion to save us. People have failed me, so I need more religion. So he continues to talk about Babylon coming. I know we're getting to the end here, and I have another whole point, But the last point is just a quick application at the end. We're watching the world spiral, trying to take care of their own challenges. So look at verse 22. He's continuing to talk about Babylon coming. The voice thereof shall go like a serpent. They shall march with an army and come against her with axes as hewers of wood. They shall cut down her forest, saith the Lord. Though it cannot be searched, because they are more than the grasshoppers and are innumerable. He pictures Babylon like an army of lumberjacks walking through them like a forest and just cutting down all the trees. They come with their axes like hewers of wood and cut her down like a forest. Look at verse 24. The daughter of Egypt shall be confounded. She shall be delivered into the hand of the people of the north. The Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, saith, behold, I will punish the multitude of No and Pharaoh and Egypt with their gods and their kings, even Pharaoh and all them that trust in him. And I will deliver them into the hand of those that seek their lives, and into the hand of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, into the hand of his servants. And afterward it shall be inhabited as in the days of old, saith the Lord. The only difference between this section and the ones before is that he mentions all the gods that they trusted. And Egypt had plenty of gods to trust. What's really interesting is that when you actually look at the gods of Egypt and you compare them to the plagues of Egypt from Exodus, there is a god for all of the issues that they had. The earth turned to lice. There's an earth god that they worshiped. The sun went dark, but there was a sun god that they worshiped. Their cattle had a disease and died, but they had a cattle god that they worshiped. Their locust came and destroyed all their crops, but they had a locust god that they worshiped. Their water turned to blood, but they worshiped the Nile as a god. All of those gods were supposed to take care of them, and each one of them failed them very specifically to show that the Israelite God, that they didn't know, who is this God that I should let you come and worship him? But now they found out who he was. And he says to them once again, your gods are going to fail you. You turn from men, and they turn to religion. They're worshiping again. Let's look back to the gods to save us. People are willing to be religious. The problem with our country is not that it isn't religious. The problem with our country is that it isn't godly. The problem with our country is not that they don't do religious practices or they don't run to religious buildings, but that they're not like Jesus. When people are on the bottom, they might turn to church. They might turn to Christianity, whatever branch promises the most at the moment. Pentecostalism might promise a religious experience. The Jehovah's Witnesses might promise that everything's going to be all right. There's no hell. It'll all turn out in the end. The Mormons promise that you can have your own universe. If you do it their way, then you can be the God of your own spot. Or maybe they turn to Buddhism, which we just need to center ourselves, and we just need to meditate more and become one with the universe, flow with the river, as it were. Whatever, and which by the way, as ridiculous as it sounds, specifically a normal response right now, the New Age movement, especially on the West Coast. That's how we're responding, is spirituality, whatever that means for me right now. Remember, this is what Saul did. I was just thinking about this when I looked over my notes. It's not in my notes. This is what Saul did. He got to the end of chapter of 1 Samuel. He didn't know what to do. The Philistines were about to fight against him. He was walking to the battle of Mount Gilboa, and he didn't know how to respond, and he asked God for help. And we're all sitting back here like, wow, Saul's turned around. He's spiritual, isn't he? No, he doesn't know what to do. So he turned to religion. One book, 1 Samuel, tells us that he turned to God. 1 Chronicles tells us that he didn't turn to God. Now, how are both those things true at the same time? Saul asked God for help, but Saul's heart was not after God. So God did not respond. Well, it's God's fault. It's not God's fault because Saul was turning to religion, not to the Lord. And we know that because of how he responded immediately after. What did he do next? Well, God's not going to respond. I'll go to a witch. If that's option 2, your heart is not seeking after God. If you turn into a Wiccan tomorrow because church didn't do it for you today, then you're not actually seeking the Lord, you're seeking religion and spirituality. This world is filled with religious people who are reacting just like the world does because it's not religion that helps us. We don't need another idol, we don't need another god, we don't need another ritual, we need Christ. And if our life is not actually seeking after him, we are going to be very disappointed with another version of the world's answers to our problems. And we see this spiral in all the lives of the people around us, and they're all at varying stages of it. You might be meeting the young person who is confidently about to take the world by storm and is just about to retreat. Maybe the guy's finding a lot of problems and he's going downward. And now, then you have the guy who's going to Facebook message you tomorrow and ask you to pick up the pieces for their bills. We're all at those varying stages around us. How does the Christians respond to that? Two verses at the end of the chapter, he looks back at Israel and he says a brief thing to them in relation to his message to Egypt. And so I want to read that before we're done. The reminder to God's people. Look at verse 27. He says, "But fear not thou, O my servant Jacob, and be not dismayed, O Israel, for behold, I will save thee from afar off, and thy seed from the land of their captivity. And Jacob shall return and be in rest and at ease, and none shall make him afraid. Fear thou not, O Jacob, my servant, saith the Lord, for I am with thee. I will make a full end of all the nations whither I've driven thee, but I will not make a full end of thee, but correct thee in measure, yet I will not leave thee wholly unpunished." So, two quick things. What is our response to seeing the world spiraling around us, flailing, as it were, for some answer to their problems, whether it's them or somebody else or some religion? What is our response to it? Letter A, don't trust the world. That doesn't mean be cynical about all the people. It means don't place your trust in them. This is not by accident. Chapter 46, Egypt being talked about first is not by accident immediately after all of the message previous to it. Israel just ran to Egypt for help and safety and security and stability, didn't they? And here we have this message given to them. Egypt is no more safe than you are without me. When we see these things in the world around us, we need to be reminded of the fact that the world is not where we should place our trust. They're trusting money, and they're trusting things, and they're trusting their jobs, and they're trusting the government to take care of them. And we need to be reminded that if it's not going well for them, it's not going to go any better for us. Better to put our trust in the Lord than to put confidence in man. They're sitting in Egypt, which is destined to fall apart because they think that they're going to give them safety. Don't trust in the world. And letter B, don't believe you're bound to the same fate. He reminds them that while some of Judah might be swept away in Egypt's demise, but only because they went down to them for help. They put themselves in the spot to be cursed. He reminds them that Egypt's fall does not guarantee their failure. God has one plan for one person and another plan for another. If the world's falling apart around you, you don't have to fall apart with it. That's a continual story throughout this book. As Jerusalem was falling, Jeremiah didn't. As the nation was falling apart, Baruch was okay if he would just trust God. And here he says to the Israelites themselves, if you're just because Egypt falls and you think, oh, well, if Egypt falls, then there's no hope anywhere, doesn't mean it has to affect you. Sometimes we get scared, don't we? We shake our heads as we look at individual lives of people. But then as we look at the mass of people that we're surrounded with, well, if all of their lives are falling apart, certainly mine will too, because I live here. And God has to remind us, no, your fate is not bound by the world's power, but by my power. And so I can do in your life exactly what I want. So don't believe that you're bound to the same fate as the falling world around you, just because you live nearby them, as if God's not more powerful than that. And so as we see the world flailing to survive, remember that our success is not determined by their success. We can thrive in our life and in our family even if our neighbors do not. But it's up to us to where we place our trust. This is just an example of Egypt placing their trust in themselves, in man, in religion, and it doesn't work out for them. And as a reminder to Israel, you need to place your trust in the Lord because that is where your safety is. So we started with Egypt. We're going to move on to Moab next, Philistia next week. And we'll see what we can learn there.